Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
A distinguished guest joins us tonight. Theodore W. Grippo was a leading lawyer in town for many years. He's one of the people, one of the main lawyers who helped take the Tribune Company public some while ago, though that had some consequences that neither he nor I nor all sorts of other people anticipated. But that's not our subject tonight. Our subject tonight is a great crime and possibly a great injustice in the history of this country. The new book by Theodore Grippo is titled With Malice Aforethought, The Execution of Niccolò Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti. The Sacco and Vanzetti case. It remains one of the continued conflicts, really, and a persisting argument, I suppose, in legal circles even to this day.
It certainly does. It's hard to explain, but it one of his defense lawyers, appellate. I want to make a distinction between appellate lawyers and trial lawyers. His appellate lawyer was Herbert Ehrman, and he wrote a book called he wrote a book on this, The Case That Will Not Die.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's persisted.
The case begins on a particular date, April 15, 1920, in South Braintree, a suburb of Boston.
That is correct.
What happened?
What happened there is that several bandits waited by a railing, by a crossing, and as a payroll was brought by two men, a payroll guard and the paymaster. And these two men—
Brought to what company?
Well, it was they were with the Slater-Morrill Shoe Company. Mm. This was a shoe town. And they were bringing the payroll down to the plant, and suddenly these two fellows that were waiting by the side jumped out and shot them, grabbed the payroll boxes. A car came up the road with a driver and somebody in the back seat, and then another bandit came from behind an excavation. The three threw the payroll boxes into the car, into the getaway car, and off it went. And it was dumping out these big tacks that were weighted so that they would stand upright and blow out the tires.
And the police and all the local law enforcement are very exercised by all of this. They're very aroused. They're searching. They're hunting. They want to capture these murderers.
Absolutely.
Two men were murdered on the scene.
Right.
And it's only 3 weeks later that they arrest the two men who are at the center of your book, Niccolò Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti. Who were they?
Well, they were two Italian immigrant workers. They had come over from Italy here some 8, 7 or so years earlier, and they got acquainted, and they were active in what would be called the anarchist movement. Now, you understand that the anarchists were they weren't flaming crazies in the street breaking windows totally. They were individuals who believed that the economy should come to the final resting point of Marxist socialism, which is the withering away of the state, and that all the workers would run everything. They'd own everything. They'd run everything, and to each according to his needs and from each
according
to
their— That was the utopian dream.
That was the utopian
dream. Of Marxism and of the various Marxist-inspired movements in Europe and, to be sure, in this country as well in those years. And all of that got a great boost forward with the achievement of the Russian Revolution.
Absolutely. That was the 1917 Russian Revolution, and socialism was spreading across Europe and it was coming to our shores.
And we reached a level where something that was labeled by journalists, at least, as the Red Scare began to dominate.
It did, and the Red Scare was actually, I go back to Eugene V. Debs as the sort of origin of the Red business. He was a socialist and he ran for president. He got a lot of votes in recent years, and the public was getting very concerned. And then there was the Attorney General Palmer, and he began to make raids on the various socialists and anarchists.
Those are in the years during the war and after the war.
Yes, they were.
And the civil liberties guaranteed by the Bill of Rights were not fully honored.
They were not at all honored. Yeah. It was a different era. And I will say this, that not only the civil liberties, but there was also the other questions that of how they handled trials. And take Massachusetts, for mm-hmm. example. Can you believe that these two fellows had to defend themselves from within a steel cage in the courtroom at that time? Can you believe that? They were required to walk from the jail to the courthouse four times a day, back and forth, with an armed guards all around them, mm-hmm. some on horseback. And as they walked through the streets of Dedham, that's where the trial took place, all the onlookers would look, and the women would hide behind windows. And
very dramatic scenes. But what was the case against them? What was the evidence that led the cops to arrest these guys only 3 weeks after the murders?
Oh, there was no evidence to arrest them. They were arrested.
Well, what provoked that arrest?
All right. What provoked that arrest was an automobile that was being repaired at a nearby shop. And the police figured that whoever came for that automobile were probably the bad fellows that committed this crime. And so they followed these guys, and they got on the Sacco and Vanzetti got on a streetcar. After they went to pick up the car, they weren't going to pick it up, but they were with other people that were going to pick it up. So the car wasn't quite ready. They didn't have license plates, so they let it go. And Sacco and Vanzetti got on a streetcar. They were going home, and Officer Conley, with drawn gun, trailed them and got on that streetcar and arrested them. Now, there was no warrant for the arrest. There really wasn't any crime committed in the presence of the officer.
It established that that car was the car that was used by the murderers?
No, it was never the car that was used. The car that was used by the murderers was a Buick sedan, a large touring car. The car they were trying to pick up was a little dinky car of that age.
So it's your impression then that Sacco and Vanzetti were arrested because they sort of fit the prejudice pattern that prevailed at that time.
You're absolutely right. They fit the prejudice. They were Italian immigrants. They were involved with the anarchists. I mean, they used to buy the anarchist newspapers mm-hmm. and so on. But there was never any evidence, ever, that they committed violent acts.
They go to trial and they are convicted, and ultimately some 6 or 7 years later, they are executed.
They are.
Your focus is on the trial and how the trial was misused, how the trial yes. was essentially maneuvered and manipulated.
Yeah, that's correct.
And you seem to discover the possibility that the presiding judge actually himself arranged to fake some of the evidence. That's a very strong charge.
It is.
We'll look at the grounds for that charge when we return, right after we pause for a quick round of commercials, and then back to Theodore Grippo. The title of the book that we're drawing from, only recently published, is With Malice Aforethought, The Execution of Niccolò Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Now, before we get back to Sacco and Vanzetti, let's talk a little bit about Grippo.
Yes.
Another good Italian name.
Right.
Your parents were Italian immigrants.
Oh, yes. They came here about the time of Sacco and Vanzetti.
About the same vintage.
Yes.
Yeah. And I know, because I've read about this, that your father was deeply involved in the case and talked to you about it as you were coming to consciousness.
Yes. I wouldn't say he was involved, but he followed it.
I mean that he was an actor in the case.
But he,
that was off in Massachusetts, and he was here in Chicago.
Right. But what happened is I was about 10 years old when I heard the words Sacco and Vanzetti, and I asked him, who are they? What's this all about? And he did sit down and tell me that they were two men, two Italians, immigrants, that were convicted of a robbery and a murder, and that they were executed, but that many people thought they were innocent.
So many did, and that persisted. That was one of the main themes on the American left, in fact.
It was.
That these were martyrs to capitalism, to the illegality of capitalism itself. We don't necessarily have to buy that whole condemnation to understand how this was figural for left consciousness, so to speak.
Yes,
though probably lots of others who were not particularly leftist and Marxist and so on also sensed the indignity and sense the injustice.
Oh, absolutely. In that very case. Absolutely. And one of the leading persons was Professor Felix Frankfurter from Harvard, who later became a Supreme Court justice.
Yeah. And writers, Edmund Wilson, the great critical writer, was interested. Maxwell Anderson
wrote two plays
on the subject. John Dos Passos, the great American novelist.
He wrote on it as well.
And somebody also who celebrated Sacco and Vanzetti and the cruelty of their fate was the great, to be sure, also very much a leftist in his political identity, but also a great artist drawing upon folk materials, namely Woody Guthrie. And here's Woody Guthrie's song about Sacco and Vanzetti.
Say there, did you hear the news? Sacco worked at trimming shoes. Vanzetti was a peddling man, pushed his fish cart with his hand. Two good men a long time gone. Two good men a long time gone. Sacco and Vanzetti are gone. They left me here to sing this song. Sacco's born across the sea, somewhere over in Italy. Vanzetti born, appearance fine, drank the best Italian wine. Sacco sailed to sea one day, landed up in the Boston Bay. Vanzetti sailed the ocean blue and landed up in Boston too. Two good men's a long time gone. Two good men's a long time gone. Two good men's a long time gone. Left me here to sing this song. Sacco's wife, three children had. Sacco was a family man. Vanzetti was a dreaming man. His book is always in his hands. Sacco earned his bread and butter being the factory's best shoe cutter. Vanzetti spoke both day and night, told the workers how to fight. Two good men a long time gone. Two good men a long time gone. Two good men a long time gone. Left me here to sing this song. I'll tell you if you ask me about this payroll robbery. Two clerks is killed by the shoe factory on the street in South Braintree. Judge there told his friends around that he had cut the radicals down. Anarchist bastard was the name Judge Thayer called these two good men. I'll tell you the prosecutor's name, Katzman, Adams, Williams, Kane. The judge and lawyer strutted down, they done more tricks than circus clowns. Two good men's a long time gone. Two good men's a long time gone. Two good men's a long time gone. Left me here to sing this song. Vanzetti docked in 1908, slept along the dirty street. Told the workers organizing on the electric chair he dies. All you people ought to be like me and work like Sacco and Vanzetti and every day find ways to fight on the union side for the workers' rights.
Unnecessary faith. But that really gives you a sense of how that case and those ostensibly martyred victims were figural, were symbolic for sort of the union movement, the left-wing movement in this country from the 20s through the 30s. And this is still felt. And indeed, you still feel there's a deep injustice or you wouldn't have written this book.
That's right. Well, if you look at the last chapter of my book called The Epilogue, I trace all the literature, all the
There's
art,
a vast amount of it, I know.
A vast amount of it from 1920 all the way till recently. It just shows you that this is a case that will not die.
Now, in that very song that we just heard by Woody Guthrie, he mentions Judge Thayer.
Oh, yes.
He was the presiding judge. He mentions a number of the other people involved in the case.
Katzman.
He was the prosecutor.
He was one of the prosecutors, yeah.
We have to get quickly to the judicial scene itself. What was wrong with it? There's so much interesting detail about all of it in your book, with malice aforethought, but we can't develop all of that
in
the short time available. You have come to the conclusion that a great injustice was done. What was it? Who did it?
Well, there was a group, and I have to say I must say that Judge Thayer, I think, was at the center of it. And Judge Thayer was responsible for removing six important documents from the record. And he actually altered the record. And I tell you, that was an obstruction of justice of great import. This is a capital murder case.
And what sort of documents did he remove from the record?
Well, they were they related to an opinion that he had given, and the fact that that opinion was appealed to the Supreme Court. And notices of that appeal were given, and Sacco had made a motion and so on. And he actually caused the removal of those documents. And I found it because I went through the docket sheets. Now, that's it's like reading a phone book, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's the docket sheets. And I want to show you this, Milt, the one in red there. That you'll see those six documents. They're in the docket sheet, but the documents are not in the record of the case. They were removed. See those in red? I've marked those in red.
Oh, yes. I'm looking at it right now.
And so that—
And I'm holding it up to the microphone so all of our listeners can see it.
Yeah, that's good. But at any rate, that's what that document. Now, if you turn the page, you'll see a document. There it is. It's a motion by Sacco. And in the far left corner at the bottom, you'll see in the judge's own handwriting that he granted Sacco the motion that Sacco asked for a time extension. Now, that's all denied by the actual opinion that became released to the public. So here we caught him in a lie, an absolute lie.
Their lawyer was a man named Fred Moore.
Yeah, he was one of their lawyers. He was their chief lawyer, trial lawyer.
Yeah, trial lawyer.
Well, this is important because he was not that good.
Apparently not.
No.
He politicized the case instantly.
Oh, absolutely.
Which probably was the wrong tactic.
Yes, he politicized it. He was a rascal. I mean, he came to court barefoot some days. Other days he slept on the lawn with a newspaper over his head.
But he was a famous sort of
lawyer. He was a labor lawyer that got involved with the Wobblies, as you know.
Uh-huh.
And he began that whole idea of defending against capitalism and so on. He was more interested in the politics of these cases.
And another man involved, the man who, in fact, brought Moore into the case, was a major figure in leftist agitation in those days, Carlos Tresca.
Tresca was he's the one that recommended Fred Moore. Fred Moore had been involved in another case, very famous labor case there in Massachusetts earlier, and he brought in Fred Moore, and Sacco didn't like Fred Moore,
mm-hmm.
and Sacco's wife didn't like. They felt that he was in it either for the fame or the money.
He was too histrionic, obviously.
Yeah. He was a wild.
Now, another very important aspect of all of this, and this apparently is your discovery, is the matter of the barrel on the revolvers. Explain.
Well, the barrels. One of the experts for the state claimed that the barrel of Sacco's gun was switched. And that opened up a whole investigation by Judge Thayer. He said it was his personal investigation, had nothing to do with the trial, and so on. And that's the decision he wrote dated March 25. Now, I conclude that decision was a ruse. The purpose of that decision was threefold. It was to permit a switching of switching of Sacco's gun for the gun that produced counterfeit bullet 3. And bullet 3 was the bullet that was fatal to the guard, that killed the guard for which they are being prosecuted. And that was one of the chief reasons. It was also to try to blame Sacco's ballistic expert for switching the barrels. Now, you don't want to confuse switching the guns, and this is the barrels, to get a new trial. So those were some of the things that were involved.
But you're alleging there an actual illegal act by the judge.
Yes.
Essentially organizing a way of faking the evidence.
Absolutely. And I call it an obstruction of justice. Yeah. And that's a crime.
It is indeed. And we need to talk more about it.
Okay.
And we need to talk about the appeals. And we need to talk as well about how the president of Harvard University
got involved.
Gets involved in
yes.
this case.
Okay.
All to follow right after we pause for an update on the evening's news from Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And back to the moment of truth, rather the moment of falsehood, the conviction. After some 6 weeks in that trial, the jury gets it. How long does it take them to convict?
Well, there's two stories to that. It took them about an hour, actually, but they held off. They said, oh, we can't come back that fast, so let's have dinner first and make it look like we spent some time on this. They actually came to their conviction in 1 hour.
What's the responsibility of the judge? The judge is supposed to charge the jury and set up the task before them. Did he give them a decent charge?
Well, the charge was very one-sided. I mean, if you were to read it, all the instructions led you to no other conclusion other than they were guilty.
That's the point. Yeah.
And that's what happened here. It was hardly a balanced charge.
And they're sentenced to death?
They are.
Well, they're found guilty in 1921, but they're not sentenced to death until some 6 years later. That's
correct. It went on. What happened is that there's a perfunctory motion that lawyers make right after a conviction. It's a motion to review the case on the grounds that it's against the manifest weight of the evidence. So Judge Thayer decided to write a 50-page opinion denying that, and it really led to some unexpected consequences. What happened is that the lawyers for Sacco and Vanzetti immediately filed a series of motions for a new trial, one after another, and it took years to get those accomplished, and that stretched things out. Then they filed a petition, the Sacco people filed a petition for clemency, and that went before a committee was appointed, and that committee was headed by the president of Harvard,
A. Lawrence Lowell.
Lowell, yes, he was a very bigoted type man. He was known for that, and he and president of MIT, Stratton, and then a local probate judge. It was very anti-Italian. I mean, he had gone to Italy, and I guess he got pickpocketed, and he never stopped talking
about
that.
So you're pretty convinced that anti-Italian prejudice of a general and diffuse sort, diffuse around that area, Boston and upper New England, that has a major role in the conviction?
I really believe that. I don't like to make a rant about that, but the Italians were very, very negatively viewed. And it goes back, really, to the early 1900s when they had that terrible, terrible lynching in New Orleans. And many people really got much opposed to Italian. They were very negatively thought of. That was the country's largest lynching. 11 Italians were executed there, and that carried forward. And I will tell you this, that except for blacks, Italians, immigrants, were lynched more than any other ethnic group in our country.
There's a literary contribution by Vanzetti to the American canon, so to speak. It is quoted in many sources, and it plays a major role, strangely, in a play, the play called The Male Animal, which was then made into a fine movie with Henry Fonda playing the role of a professor at Ohio State University, a university at which I once taught for 2 years.
Really?
Long after these events. Henry Fonda, as the professor, wants to read Vanzetti's oration, and the people who run the university come down upon him and say, this is communism in itself, we can't allow it, but he stands on his rights. More complicated than that, but that's
And then he reads it.
And then he reads
could
it.
Could I read it to you?
I want you to. That's why I've led
All right,
up to this, it this
way. All right, it's not long, but it's very powerful. Here's what he says.
This is Vanzetti. Vanzetti is the intellectual.
Very intellectual, very literary, and poetic in his own way. Now,
but not a full master of the English language.
No, not a full master. And you'll see some of the broken language. Let me read it. He says, if it had not been for these thing, I might have live out my life talking at street corners to scorning men. I might have die, unmarked, unknown, a failure. Now we are not a failure. This is our career and our triumph. Never in our full life could we hope to do such work for tolerance, for justice, for men's understanding of man, as now we do by accident. Our words, our lives, our pains, nothing. The taking of our lives, lives of a good shoemaker and a poor fish peddler, all. That last moment belonged to us. That agony is our triumph. And that was the narration, that was the matter that Henry Fonda spoke about.
When did he say that? How close?
Well, he said that several months before he was executed.
Yeah.
It was in a meeting with a newspaper man who took it down and reported it later.
It's very moving.
It is very moving. Very moving. And he said a lot of other things. I wish I could name them all, but they're in the book. I mean, he wrote a lot of beautiful stuff. He was very intellectual. His appellate lawyer, wonderful man, Mr. Thompson. He was the leading member of the Boston Bar. He took on Sacco and Vanzetti along with Herbert Ehrman, the two of them. Mm-hmm. They gave their lives to these two guys to try to save them. And Thompson used to say if Vanzetti only had an education, he'd make a great Harvard professor.
And the attempt to get them cleared persisted long after their execution.
Oh, it's been a story that's gone on and on. And I'll tell you, we know who did it. Everybody knows who did it. The Morelli gang. The Morelli gang from Providence, Rhode Island. There is more evidence outlined in the book that they were the culprits that did it and not Sacco and Vanzetti. But Sacco and Vanzetti were they were involved in this crazy anarchist movement of the time. And I'm convinced that Judge Thayer teamed up with Prosecutor Katzman to clean up the anarchists. They had to get rid of these two fellows. The Boston office of the FBI was clear that these two fellows were not involved.
And when we zoom forward into the 1970s, there's a governor sitting there in the State House in Boston named Michael Dukakis.
Absolutely.
And something very interesting happens with regard to Sacco and Vanzetti.
Well, what Dukakis does is he engages two lawyers, a fellow by the name of Sella and Dershowitz, two lawyers from Harvard.
Is that our friend Alan Dershowitz?
That's your friend Alan Dershowitz.
Still a great figure at Harvard.
Yes, he is. And Sella, I'm not sure where he is now, but they headed up a report. And they gave a scathing report on the unfairness of the trial. So Governor Dukakis issued a proclamation declaring August 23rd Sacco and Vanzetti Memorial Day in Boston. And this erupted into a big political thing in Boston. And the Senate was going to vote it down, the State Senate, and the this and the that. And they finally tabled it, all their objections, and the proclamation still stands. It's not a legal holiday or anything like that, but it's still there. And I understand that each year a candlelight group marches from the jailhouse to the execution chamber and candlelight in memory of Sacco and Vanzetti, still going on today.
Sacco left a wife and, what, three children?
He left two children. They did have three, but one died early in birth. Two children.
Did Vanzetti have children?
No, he did not. He never married.
He was not married.
No, he was not. They were relatively young men, you know, when they died.
Who are the Sacco descendants?
Well, the Sacco descendants were Dante, his son, and Inez. That's the first layer of descendants. Yeah. And then Dante got married. And so did Inez, and they had children. And Dante had Spencer and two others. And unfortunately, Dante died. But I make the point that they had a progeny of good citizens. Dante was a splendid citizen. When he died in his 50s, 500 people attended his funeral.
Who are the Sacklers these days?
Well, the Sacklers are there. I don't know them.
You haven't looked them
up? I haven't talked to them. Mm-hmm. But they decided to stay in the locale and live under the Sacko name.
Mm-hmm.
And their mother, Rose, Sacko's wife, she ended up living till in the 1990s, in an old people's home. And it's quite an interesting group.
Sacko was a shoemaker.
He was a shoemaker.
From Italy, and so was your father.
Absolutely, my father was. And he had that identification with Sacko. And he was worried about the attitude of Americans towards Italians because of the Sacco-Vanzetti case.
There's a center up at Northwestern run by an old friend of mine, Rob Warden.
Oh, yes.
Which is focused on this kind of injustice and tries to redeem it.
Yes, it's called the Center for Wrongful Convictions. And they've done a marvelous job in the last—
They've got lots of people off death row over the years.
About the last 15 years, I think they've succeeded in about 20 instances. And Rob read my book, and he bought 5 copies and passed it around his office. And he asked me to join the board of the advisory board, and I had my first meeting, and I'm very happy to work with them.
More than once, in fact, 3 or 4 times over the last 20 or 25 years, Rob has come on the program together with somebody just recently sprung from the Death House by Rob and his friends at the center.
Yes, they're at Northwestern Law School. They are like the Innocence Project that exists in many other cities, yes.
Well, they're the model for it.
They are the model
projects
for it.
In other cities.
Yes, they are.
We're about to pause for the usual reasons, but before that, it is time to invite telephone calls. We're opening the lines at this instant. Any question you've got about the case, and there's much more detail in the case, of course, than we've been able to develop in this rather brief run-through, but now's your opportunity to seek that further detail. 312-591-7200. Also, of course, one thinks of many possible parallels to this case. There's a good deal of injustice in the world, and even in this country, or Rob Warden and his colleagues up at Northwestern wouldn't be so heavily employed.
That's right.
In trying to reverse essentially false convictions.
There have been hundreds of them that have.
Exactly.
Through the DNA. A lot of it is through DNA.
That sort of redemption possible now.
Yes, it has.
312-591-7200 is where you reach us. Get in there very quickly if you are so inclined, so we can work you in the last portion of the program. Again, 312-591-7200. And for those listening on the Internet or who are otherwise disposed to get to us via email, the email address is, as ever, extension 720 at wgnradio.com. Extension 720 as one word at wgnradio.com. And again, for phones, 312-591-7200. We return and on to your contributions right after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Our guest tonight, Theodore W. Grippo, is the author of the book With Malice Aforethought, The Execution of Niccolò Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti. Who are the publishers, by the way?
Well, it's iUniverse out of Bloomington, Indiana.
Mm-hmm. Readily available wherever they sell real books.
Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble.
Excellent. 312-591-7200 is the number. We've got room on the board for more calls. If you want to be heard, get in there instantly. 312-591-7200. Bill has joined us. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yeah. Carlo Testa said they were guilty. Well, he said at least that Sacco wasn't, Vanzetti was not going to think on him. The family will never speak to anyone because they would have to admit it. But the main thing is the ballistics that are available. The gun is the one. The bullet fits the gun. And the lawyer tried to change it. She tried to switch barrels in the court case, but he got caught at it. So they got the right barrel back in the gun. The other thing is that the lawyer talked to Sinclair Lewis. Sinclair Lewis wrote a letter saying, well, I know they're guilty, but I can't put it in my book on Boston because my readership in Europe especially would not like that. So I'll go with Carla Treska, Sinclair Lewis, and The Lawyer.
Very interesting. That's a strong challenge to the thesis developed by Ted Grippo.
Yes, it is.
Your response, sir?
Well, my response is that those arguments have been around for many years, but they've been overblown by the fact that the Morelli gang did it.
And how does one know that?
Well, how does one know that? There's the confession by Celestino Medeiros, who was in the robbery and murder, and he swore that Sacco and Vanzetti were not part of it. There's the involvement of the other people that, for example, there's a fellow by the name of Vincent Teresa. He wrote My Life in the Mafia, and he talked to Butsy Morelli, and Butsy Morelli admitted that they did it. A cellmate of Joe Morelli admitted that Joe Morelli confessed to him. And the interesting thing is that Sacco was a lookalike with Joe Morelli. They look the same. I can show you the pictures here, the mugshots. You can see it. So there is more evidence that the Morellis did it than that Sacco and Vanzetti did it. And in fact, Herbert Urban wrote a wonderful book called The Untried Case, where he lays all of this out.
Well, I find your interview, it's very nicely done, but the bullets.
Oh, the bullets. That's
matched the gun.
No, no.
And the gun was found in his pocket.
I know, but what you got to understand. No, no. What you got to understand, that Sacco's gun was switched. You
no,
got to understand. Yes, it was. No, no. You got
to
understand that bullet three, the bullet that killed the guard, was a counterfeit.
Sir, that's all we can do with it. I thank you for your clear representation.
Sir,
that's all we can do with it right now. Time is
okay,
very short.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank
very
you
good.
For an interesting contribution, to be sure. 312-591-7200. And next up is Tony. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hello. I wonder how long it took Ted to write the book.
I spent 7 years writing the book.
And how did you obtain the pictures?
How did I obtain the pictures?
Yes.
Oh, how did you know there were pictures in there? I guess you got the book.
Yes, I do.
Oh, well, I got most of the pictures from the Boston trustees of the public library.
Mm-hmm.
The other pictures were pre-1923, which are in the public domain.
Wonderful. It sounds like you did so much work on it. And how about the children? Did they allow his children to come and visit when they were?
Oh, yes. But, you know, there's a touching scene. I want to tell you about this.
Mm-hmm.
That Dante, the young boy, used to go to the prison wall when his father had was given exercise time, and they used to play catch over the prison wall.
Oh, so sad.
It was so touching. And Inez was much younger, but both Inez and Dante were brought to see their father quite often, and it was those scenes that Celestino Medeiros saw that urged him to tell that Sacco and Vanzetti were not part of the crime, even though he was.
Ma'am, we thank you for the call.
Thank you so much.
Glad to have heard from you. Going back to that first caller, there is then a counterparty, apparently.
There must
be authors who have written articles or even books insisting that Sacco and Vanzetti were guilty.
I would like to correct that a little bit. They would say that Sacco might have been guilty, but
yeah,
Vanzetti wasn't. That was called a split theory.
I see.
Francis Russell, a rather renowned writer, wrote Tragedy in Denim, and that's the ultimate conclusion he came to, although he originally started out arguing that they were both innocent.
Uh-huh. And the argument persists to this day.
It persists to this day.
Interesting. I want to read you something which comes from a listener who's probably a lawyer. And he asks, did this trial raise any questions of exculpatory evidence or due process violations? Were any due process or evidentiary laws retooled or redefined as a result of this trial?
Well, he's very astute. Some years after the trial, after the executions, I should say, the Massachusetts legislature finally amended their laws in such a way that had those amendments been in existence, Sacco and Vanzetti would assuredly gotten a new trial. Yes, they were changed. At the time of the case, all the power was vested in the trial judge, and it could only be set aside if he breached his discretion, and that is very difficult to do. In other words, all the power and decision-making was vested in the trial judge.
Last question, again via email. What were the international perceptions of the case at the time?
They were very much in favor of Sacco and Vanzetti. When they were executed, eruptions burst on every major city in the world, from Japan to South America to England to Italy to France to Germany. They were stoning the American embassy. They were overturning cars. They were burning American flags. It was an international incident.
So this case became then, and may even persist to this day, as one of the items in an anti-American indictment as developed elsewhere in the world.
Well, I guess you'd have to say that, Milt. Sad is to say. I want you to know one thing. The book that I wrote is not a defense of anarchism.
Oh, sure.
It is clearly all about due process and the law.
You are, and were for many years, a leading corporate lawyer in this town.
Well,
I wouldn't expect you to to wave the banner of anarchism.
Well,
anarchism.
Okay, I'll buy that.
The book In Hand by Theodore Grippo is titled With Malice Aforethought, The Execution of Niccolò Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti. And with that, we come to the end of the available time. Just a quick word about tomorrow. One of the great historians of World War II, Stanley Weintraub, will be our guest tomorrow for the full 2 hours, with also some sound clips from those days, and particularly from the very beginning of our involvement in World War II, because Stanley Weintraub's newest volume is titled Pearl Harbor Christmas, A World at War, December 1941. That's what we'll be doing tomorrow night, and we urge you to, if you need an extension 720 fix, simply go at any time to our website, wgnradio.com/extension720, where you will find hundreds of prior programs, both recent ones and classic ones, any one of which you can listen to streaming or download to listen to at your leisure. And with that, we wind down for the evening. Thanks to all for listening. And a most cordial good night.